So I'm picking up in volume 9 in February the 26th, 1910. And the heading is that before dying, the soul must make everything die in the divine will and in love. Now, you hear me saying frequently that the summary of the 36 volumes is divine will and love, because God is love and God is the divine will. Okay. And most people wait until they're dying to really let go of everything. And even some people struggle desperately when they're dying because they have no experience of letting anything go. Now, wise people in the spiritual life learn detachment at an early stage. So you're not clinging on to anything. And so at each stage of our growth, you've got to die to something. And mostly we're dying to self. We're dying to our own selfishness. Okay. So Louisa says, my usual state of privation continues. Perhaps it's even worse. Oh God, what a descent I have made, she said. I could never have imagined I could reach such an end. But at least I hope I will never, never go out of the circle of the holy divine will. I want you to notice the circle. In these writings, there's going to be certain mathematical designs that are considered perfect examples of what God is and what God reflects to us. And one of them is the circle. And the circle is usually the divine will. Okay. Now, a circle means that the line has neither a beginning nor an ending. That's how you manage to get back to the same point. Okay. So you'll find as Louisa goes more and more into the divine will, she keeps on saying, but this is endless. Once I get into it, I can't see a way out. That's a bit like asking a fish in the middle of the Atlantic, do you know your way out? So the fish would say to you, I never heard of a way out. Okay, this is where I live. Well, that's going to be Louise's experience as well. But she has to go into it, and it's called the circle. In other words, you keep travelling, you'll end up at this point you started with, because it's an endless line. Now, the Irish monks who did the Book of Kells understood these endless lines. And you find in their designs, they're all endless lines. No matter what the design is, it's an endless line. And the endless line represents God. And so they're actually famous for that. So she said, I hope I will never, never go out of the circle. It's the endless line of the most holy will. This is everything for me. I would like to cry over my heart-rending state, and sometimes I do, but Jesus reproaches me, telling me, you want to always be like a little girl. Now, I want to translate this to you. Jesus says, would you grow up? Sorry. Okay. But I also want to give you Song of Songs, chapter 5, verse 6. My soul failed at his flight. Song of Songs, 5, 6. So he says, you've got to grow up. It shows that I am dealing with a little girl, he says. I can't trust you. In other words, you're supposed to have become an adult by now. I was hoping to find in you the heroism of sacrifice. Oh, dear. Oh, dear. I won't ask you how you would manage if you were measured by the heroism of sacrifice. But instead, I find the tears of a little girl who wants to sacrifice. No sacrifice. Now, what he's saying to her is, this is already volume 9. She's been told endlessly the meaning of his privation. And he says that at this stage, he would expect her to make the sacrifice. And so Louise's comment is, and so if I cry, he shows himself harder. And he does one of his bravados by not coming at all for that same day. Gosh, is she impressed? No, that's amazing. Therefore, I have to pluck up courage and keep crying away from me. And I said to Jesus, you say that you deprive me of yourself out of love. And for love of you, I accept your privation. Now, you have to know that this is done with gritted teeth. For love of you, I will not cry. So my comment in the margin is 10 out of 10. You got the message. And if I manage it, he shows himself a little bit more indulgent. In other words, he's trying to push her on a bit. Otherwise, he penalizes me more with his privation, dying continuously, though living. Then after spending a day like this, as much as I tried, I could not hold back my tears. Oh, Jesus made me pay for it, as I deserve. But late at night, having compassion for me, as if it just a window of light had opened in my mind, he made himself seen and he told me, "Don't you want to understand that before dying, that is before going to God, you must die to everything. You must die to suffering, to desires, to favors, to everything. And that everything must die in my will and in my love." Now, this is another way of talking about the nothingness, which I absolutely love in Louisa's writings. Nothingness is way beyond humility. Because if you know you're humble, then the ego is still alive. and here he's saying, look, you know that you've got to let go of everything in order to come to me. Now, he's going to explain over and over again why this is so. He's already explained it in volume 4, but I dare say you don't remember.
No.
And he says that the material and the spiritual cannot mix. Just as oil and water don't mix. They just don't. And if you mix or try to mix water with melted iron, are they going to mix? No, there's no possibility for those objects actually mixing. And he says that the material and the spiritual cannot mix. So if we want to live a spiritual life and we're holding onto the material, then we block ourselves from going forward. Because when you get to the higher volumes above volume 20, you're going to hear Jesus telling Louisa that she's now like crystal. And crystal, the light comes through without any difficulty. So the material is no longer blocking God from actually coming through. So when we experience God as opaque and out there, then it's what is inside of us that's actually blocking the vision. It's not, the block is not on his side, the block is on our side. So he says, if you're going to die to be with him forever, that is, be totally spiritual forever, because you know you leave your body behind and you leave everything else behind as well. I remember a lovely story in which a very rich woman in America, her husband died suddenly, and they didn't realise how many relatives they had until the death notice went into the papers, you know. And then then people with connections to the 10th degree removed turned up for the funeral because they were all interested in what he left. Okay. The widow said absolutely nothing. This is actually a true story, but I add a little bit to it just to make sure you get the point. The widow said absolutely nothing to anybody about anything. She concentrated on the fact that she had lost her husband. But the rest of them who turned up for the funeral with other motivations were dying to know what he left. So at the meal after the funeral, one of the younger members who were part of this entourage that was interested in what he left couldn't hold back any further, and he said to her before the meal was over, "But aren't you going to tell us what he left?" And she stood up and she said, "I want to tell everybody that he left everything, including his body." And she closed the subject. He left everything, including his body. You see, we have to leave everything. It doesn't matter whether you have anything or you don't have it, you still have to leave it. And you go out of this world with no baggage. It's the one flight you take where no hand baggage is allowed.
There's no hitches and hearses.
So we have to learn as we go forward in the spiritual life to let things go. Now, it's not difficult, really, for generous people to let go big things. It's very difficult for us to let go our own opinion and our own image of ourselves and our own conviction about this or that or the other. So the Lord allows challenges to come to you to actually deal with that, to see, will you let it go? I had the privilege of having a friend for some years. Notice it's not there anymore. And the problem was that he was 100% right all the time. So can you imagine the possibility of having a discussion? No. There's no possibility of having a discussion, because the person was holding on tenaciously to his own opinion about everything. And I just found it extremely sad. But I could eventually I could see it clearly. But he couldn't see it, unfortunately. But anyway. So let's read this again. Don't you want to understand that before dying, that is going to God, you must die to everything. You must die to suffering. You must die to desires. You must die to favors. You must die to everything. And that everything must die in my will and in my love. Only that which enters eternity in heaven is my will and my love. That's not good English. The only thing that enters eternity is divine will and divine love, because that's who God is. Nothing else enters it. So all the virtues end, patience, obedience, sufferings and desires. Only my will and love never end. OK, that's 1 Corinthians 13:13. The greatest of these, faith, hope and love, and the greatest of these is love. 1 Corinthians 13:13. This is the last verse of 1 Corinthians, which is talking about love. Therefore, you must die in advance in my will and my love. Now, the people who will die in advance and will allow the spiritual to take over from the material are the ones who will go straight to heaven, because the job's done. But whatever has not been done while we are alive has to be done in purgatory. And so as you go on in the divine will, and the Lord is talking about living this commitment 24/7, 365, he says there's no purgatory for someone who has done that, because they've let everything go. Does that make sense? So he said, this is for all of my saints. It's not just for you as an individual, for it's anybody to enter heaven. And I myself did not want to spare myself from being abandoned by the Father, which he, remember, on the cross, so as to die completely in the will and in the love of the Father. Oh, how I would have wanted to suffer more, he said. Oh, how much more did I yearn to do for souls. But all this died in the will and love of the Father. No matter what he wanted to do, it was only what the Father wanted. So beside that, I want you to put John 14:31. I want the world to know that I love the Father, and therefore I do exactly what my Father tells me, not beyond it. You see, a person living a spiritual life can make a mistake of becoming so enthusiastic about doing something that they'll do that regardless. And the point is, it only has value if it's the will of God. Like if I was a person who really wanted to fast an awful lot and God was not actually asking me to do it, it's a total waste of time and energy. And any other activity that you do that God doesn't actually want you to do it has no value whatsoever. We have to understand that all sanctity is within the bounds of the will of God. OK, and there are times when the Lord will want you to fast, and other times he'll want you to suffer, and other times he'll want you to take time out. And the strange thing is that the person mightn't want to take the time out, because we have this image of him as cruel and hard and demanding and all the rest of it, which is very much a Sinai image of God, and it's not the image of Jesus. But it's us getting locked into a conviction that this is the way it has to be. Now, we've seen from volume 4, Louisa having great difficulty in moving over from being just a victim soul into somebody who is to open the kingdom of the divine will for everybody. That was a very difficult move for her. And in volume 9, she's not fully there. She is living in the divine will, but she's not fully in the image of I have shifted from one vocation to another. Okay. So March the 8th, 1910, I've got a VIP on this one. The upright intention is light for the soul. Now, we're talking about the intention. OK. This morning, Blessed Jesus came briefly and he told me, my daughter, the upright intention is light for the soul. Now, you know, from volume one, we've been told that the only intention that the Lord really accepts is that we do things for love of him. It converts the soul into light. Now, light is, means something completely spiritual, and God is light. So that's 1 John 1:5. God is light. And it gives her the way to operate in a divine manner. Okay, God, that's what we're aiming at in the divine will. The soul is nothing but a dark room, and the upright intention is like the sun that enters into it and illuminates it. With this difference that the sun does not turn walls into light, while the upright working transforms everything into light. The upright working is that you have the right intention and do it in the divine will, and everything is transformed onto a divine level. So March the 12th, 1910. This is another one of the many messages on love, and I have a VIP on it. The divine will perfects love. It modifies love. It constrains love. And it expands love into something holy and perfect. That's all your heading. Do you see it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, as I was in my usual state, Louisa said, Blessed Jesus came just in passing and told me, my daughter, my will perfects love. It modifies it, it shrinks it, and it expands it into something holy and perfect. So I want to give you Ephesians 2:10, where God's work of art, he keeps working on us. He never stops until we actually go to him. Sometimes love would want to run away and devour everything, but my will masters love. Now, you see what I said a moment ago? Somebody really wants to do something, but the divine will and the divine love actually puts a limit on that. And you only do what he wants. Slow down. Don't run away. Because by running away, you can hurt yourself. Or by wanting to devour everything, you can be mistaken. The language we would use in the 21st century is you get yourself stressed out and ill and maybe die. And it's God's will and God's love that knows how to keep complete balance in your life. And as we go on in these writings, you'll be told very clearly that the divine will brings balance into your life. Now, balance means that you're patient, but you're not passive. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're forgiving, but you're just. So a person can be forgiving to the level of letting everybody walk all over them, you know, but you're not meant to be anybody's doormat. So everything is balanced, and the forgiveness and the love and the service and everything is all governed by wisdom and understanding of God's will. And it's this balance that shows you a character that is being perfected in a most wonderful way. So love is pure insofar as it is conformed to my will. You see, if it's even slightly outside of the divine will, it's not pure. There's a bit of selfishness in it. And so the selfishness is the impurity. They walk together and they kiss each other continuously with the kiss of peace. Other times, either because of an inferior state or because as it escapes, it has not succeeded as it wanted, love would want to constrain me and almost sit down sluggishly. You see that you become sluggish and you're not actually active spiritually. So my will spurs it on and says, come on, true lovers are not lazy. They don't remain idle. When it is enclosed in my will, only then is love safe. Now, that statement is infinitely bigger than you think. There's an enormous amount of information in the 36 volumes about the condition of Adam and Eve before the fall, and the reason why they fell, and the condition of Adam and Eve after the fall. Now, I don't want to go into a major discussion about this now. You can have it later if you want. But the issue in the Garden of Eden was not an apple. The apple was merely a symbol, and it was a symbol of human love. The apple tree in the Bible is a symbol of human love because the apple tree is one of the most fertile plants that we have on Earth, and it produces incredible numbers of fruits every year. So because of the fruitfulness of the apple tree, it became the symbol of love. And so God asked Adam and Eve to put their human love, or to put it in our language, to put their sexuality into his divine will. And they said no. They'd know what evil was. They already knew what good was because they were living in incredible holiness. But they would know what evil was if they took the human love outside of divine will. And the 21st century, we're perfect at it, aren't we? Knowing what evil you can do by just simply keeping human love outside of God's will. But if you put human love and all its expressions inside of God's love, you can have a nest of saints like St. Teresa's family. Yeah. Just it's the first thing that came to my head. Because Jesus will explain as we go along that the divine will is the source of all happiness and peace. So if a couple have their entire relationship completely inside of the divine will, then there's only harmony and peace. And the effect that that has on the next generation is monumental. It's absolutely monumental. So that's why I say that that statement is infinitely bigger than it looks. When it is enclosed in my will, only then is love safe. Okay. So love makes one appreciate and desire something, and it is taken by follies and by excesses. While my will tempers and calms love. Do you see where the brakes are putting in on the thing? And nourishes the loving soul with a food more solid and divine. Therefore, in love, there can be many imperfections, even in holy things, while in my will, there's never imperfection. That's why as we go along in trying to live this spirituality of the divine will, the Lord does an enormous amount of purification on us. If he's not purifying you, get worried. Because he does it all the time. And even at the level that Louisa was at by volume 9, there's still a huge amount of purification for her to experience. But in the divine will, everything is perfect. Now, perfect means complete. My daughter, this happens especially in loving souls who have received the grace of my visits. Now, these loving souls with the grace of his visits are the victim souls. So you need to write victim souls there in case you think it applies to us all. They have received my visits, my kisses, my caresses. They remain prey to love, and I deprive them of, when I deprive them of myself, which of course happens to Louisa all the time. Love takes possession of them and renders them panting, fidgety, delirious, mad, restless, impatient. Now, any of those words is not a sin because you're talking about something that's going on inside of the divine will. Okay, so when Louisa goes madly looking for the Lord, he says she's impatient. Is that okay? So if it wasn't for my will that nourishes them, calms them. Now, you've heard Jesus say to Louisa endlessly, would you calm down, calm mm-hmm. down. Strengthens them. That means gives them fortitude, and it's fortitude to suffer. Love would actually kill them. Isn't that interesting? Though love is nothing but the firstborn child of my will. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. Because the divine will is the operating part of the Trinity. It needs always to be corrected by my will, and I love it as much as I love myself. So a lot of the correction that's going on between Jesus and Louisa has to do with tempering her incredible fiery love that she has for him. But we're not dealing with the area of sin. We're on a much higher path. So March 16, 1910, the narrow path to salvation. That's Matthew 7, verses 13 to 14. Many people take the broad road that leads to hell. Very few take the narrow path that leads to heaven. So Louisa said, in speaking with the confessor, he told me that it is difficult to be saved. Now, it's the priest talking, and it's 1910. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's more than a century ago. So it's the thinking that was on in the church at the time. It's difficult to be saved. For Jesus Christ himself said it, the door is narrow, you must strive to enter. So the priest is interpreting that as it's very difficult to get into the kingdom of heaven. And then after I received communion, Jesus said, poor me, how stingy they consider me. Tell the confessor, from their stinginess, they judge me. Now, their stinginess is the interpretation they're giving onto this text. Okay, so what Jesus is saying is the interpretation is wrong. They do not hold me as the great, immense, interminable, powerful being, infinite in all of my perfections, who can make great crowds of people pass through narrowness more than through wideness itself. Now, above the word narrowness, will you write nothingness? Nothingness. Anybody who will go down into this humble place of being nothing before him, he will do great things with them. So as he was saying this, I seemed to see a very narrow pathway, which led to a little door, narrow but jam-packed with people who were competing with one another to see who could advance more and more into it. Now, if you want a picture of that, you can go on the internet and look at a picture of one of the main gates into Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem. And the main gates are huge. And if they're opened, you can get carriages and cars to go through. If they close the main gates, they open a small little side door, which only a human being can walk through. You couldn't take anything except a hand luggage or a case on a trolley. But you couldn't get the camel to go through. And it's the needle's eye, they call that door. You know, it's the little door that if the merchants come in late, they can't get into the city. The city is protected. Is that okay? So you couldn't have someone coming in at night, to use our language, bringing bombs with them. So it's called the needle's eye door or the narrow door. Is that okay? And when it would come to the time for closing the gates, which would be sundown, you'd have crowds around the gates trying to get through. That's what Jesus is describing here. So I'm just trying to give you a picture of it. So Jesus said, see, my daughter, what a great crowd is pushing forward, and they compete to see who arrives first. In a competition, there's much gaining, while if the pathway were wide, nobody would even bother, knowing that there was room for them to walk on whenever they want. But while they are taking their time, death may come, and not finding themselves walking on the narrow pathway, they could find themselves on the threshold of the wide door of hell. Okay, so how much good this narrowness does, you know, that demanding a bit of humility from us so that we can get through. This happens also among yourselves. If there's a feast or a service and it is known that the place is small, everyone hurries, so they will be more spectators enjoying the feast or service. But if it is known that the place is large, nobody bothers hastening, and there will be less spectators because, knowing that there's room for everyone, they take their time, and some arrive in the middle of it, which is true of Mass and everything, some at the end, and some find everything finished, enjoying nothing. This is what would happen if the pathway of salvation were wide. Few would bother hastening, and the feast of heaven would be very few. Now, beside that whole paragraph, I want to give you Isaiah 35. There's only 11 verses in it, and it's talking about the redeemed. And it eventually says that the redeemed are walking on a pathway to God, and the unclean cannot walk on this pathway. So it's a narrow pathway to God. So March the 23rd, 1910, living in the divine will is greater than communion itself. This is a VIP message, but a VIP on this one. And at a time of persecution for the church, when Mass mightn't be that available to you, this kind of information is going to be survival stuff. Okay. As I was in my usual state and lamenting because of his privations, he came just in passing and told me, "My daughter, I recommend that you do not go out of my will, because my will contains such power," you see, it contains all the divine power, "as to be a new baptism for the soul." Now, beside your VIP, will you write "baptism in the will of God"? It's a new baptism. The Lord ordained that everybody would be baptized in water and the Spirit if it is possible. If it's not possible, have them baptized by desire. And some of them are baptized in their own martyrdom. The few people who will go seriously into the divine will, Jesus says that when you go into it 24/7, 365, not every now and then, when you're actually living in, he says, a new baptism happens to your soul and you stop being an adopted child of God, which baptism of water and the Spirit gave you. You become an actual child of God. OK. And he will come back to this point many times. I think it's in volume 14 that he explains, for example, that if you take an earthly kingdom and the king has a relationship with everybody in that kingdom, some kind of a relationship. Some of them are his army and serve him. Some of them are the farmers who look after the fields. Some of them are in his government, running things for him. Some of them are in commerce, or some of them are teaching or nursing or whatever it is. And he says, but only one of them in the entire kingdom is the queen. And only very few of them are his actual children. He could adopt many children, but very few are his actual children. So the Queen is Blessed Mother, and the actual children are the people in the divine will who have allowed this baptism to take place. Now, nobody will have to tell you if you experienced it, because it will have such a dramatic effect on your life that you yourself will know. In fact, you'd probably go needing to talk to somebody about it, like, is this thing that's happening to me, is it for real? Okay. So there are four baptisms that I know about now. Can you write down some of them? Mm-hmm. You have baptism in water. You have baptism of desire, the second one. Baptism in the Holy Spirit. Remember, that's spoken about in the scriptures. And baptism in the divine will. And it's only when you add things like that together that the Lord is bringing people to a higher and higher place. Now, if the baptism of water leaves a permanent mark on the soul, baptism in the Holy Spirit also leaves a permanent mark on the soul, as you know from Pentecost and its effect on the apostles. Baptism in the divine will is the final mark. It's the final mark of election. Okay. Now, you can also have a baptism of blood, meaning martyrdom. And I just add that on as an extra, a baptism of blood. That's quite a bit, isn't it? And you wouldn't realize it unless we actually made a list of them. So the Lord has many ways of getting people to come into his kingdom, depending on the circumstances of their lives. So let's go back to this now. My daughter, I recommend that you do not go out of my will, because my will contains such power as to be a new baptism for the soul. So I want to give you John 3, verses 3 to 8 there, where Jesus tells Nicodemus that he has to be born again. So baptism is being born again. John 3, verses 3 to 8. John 3, verses 3 to 8. And he says, it's a new baptism for the soul, even more than baptism itself, meaning baptism in water. Okay? Which leaves the first permanent mark on the soul. In fact, While in the sacraments there is part of my grace, in my will there is the fullness of it. That's the difference. Because the divine will is the source of everything. In the baptism, the stain of original sin is removed, but passions and weaknesses remain. We say concupiscence remains. Okay, so that's why it's not complete. It's not full. In my will, since the soul destroys her own volition. Now, we can't actually destroy our own volition. I mean, we have to be careful of words that are used. Your will probably die about 15 minutes after they've declared you dead. Do you know what I mean? Because the will is what makes you you. It's what makes you operate. So you can't destroy it. All you can do is put your will at the feet of the Lord. Or as Louisa describes about our Blessed Mother in her Immaculate Conception, that she put her will on the altar of God right from the very beginning. So that's all you can do. And you can see from how Louisa experiences difficulties that the will can come back very quickly. And that's why he keeps on saying to her, no, no, make sure you keep your will in mind. And we can make our dedication prayers early in the morning about putting our will in the divine will. And you can discover before lunch that you've forgotten all about it. Do you know what I mean? That's perfectly normal. And that's why it needs the reminders, you know, that you come back into it. So since the soul destroys her own will, that means puts your will under the divine will, she also destroys passions, weaknesses, and all that is human. Now, it is from the fall of Adam, the intellect was darkened and the will was weakened. They're two major results of the fall of Adam. And that's why you're told that when you put your will into the divine will permanently, that the passions and weaknesses and everything that goes with it go as well. And so you enter into a peace that literally passes all understanding. That's Philippians 4:7. Okay. And she lives of the virtues. We would say she lives out of, you know, because lives of by itself, it doesn't make that much sense in English. She lives out of the virtues and out of the fortitude and out of the divine qualities. Therefore, she's living at a divine level. Okay. So he's going to tell us in the next paragraph that divine will is a permanent communion. Divine will is permanent communion. On hearing this, Louisa said to herself, in a little while he's going to tell me that his will is greater than communion itself. And Jesus said, of course, because the sacramental communion lasts only a few minutes, 15 minutes, isn't it? Mm-hmm. While my will is perennial or permanent communion. So you can't compare 15 minutes to 24, 7, 3, 6, 5, can you? Even more, it is eternal, entering the eternity in heaven. The sacramental communion is subject to some obstacles, either because of illness or necessity in us, or because of those who have to administer it. So you can run into all kinds of obstacles. While the communion of my will is not subject to any hindrance. If the soul only wants it, all is done. That's where that little rule in your tiny booklet from Tony Hickey comes. You desire it, I do it. Is that okay? This is where it comes from. If the soul only wants it, all is done. But you have to be sure that when you say the words, it's a real desire of yours. It's not just words from your lips. No one can prevent the soul from having such a great good which forms the happiness of the earth and of heaven. Neither demons nor human beings, and not even my omnipotence itself. The soul is free. No one has any right over her at this point in my will. That's why I want to give you Romans 8:31-39. Romans 8:31-39. That means nothing can separate us from the love of Christ. And he gives you a whole long list of what can't separate you from the love of Christ. The only thing that can separate you from the love of Christ is your will. Okay, so when we put our will on the throne of God and leave it there and walk away, then we're free. He said, this is why I push it and I want so much that people will take it. It's the most important thing for me, the thing which I cherish the most. All other things do not interest me as much, not even the holiest ones. And when I obtain, when I get to the point, we would say, that the soul actually lives in my will, I feel triumphant. Because this is the greatest good that can exist either in heaven or on earth. Isn't that an incredible statement? Mm-hmm. So when he gets the soul to the point where they've actually given this fully and completely, this is the triumph of his sacred heart, if I can use our language, okay? So April the 10th, 1910, is preparation and thanksgiving for communion. Louisa says, I write to obey, but I feel my heart break from the effort I'm making. But viva obedience, viva will of God. I write, but I tremble, and I myself don't know what I'm saying. Obedience wants me to write. That means the priest has ordered it. He wants me to write something about how I prepare myself and how I thank blessed Jesus at communion. Naturally enough, because the priest wants a bit of help himself and wants to pass it on to us. That's why he's trying to get her to do it. I don't know how to say anything about it because my sweet Jesus, in seeing my incapacity, that's John 15:5, without me you can do nothing. John 15:5. In seeing my incapacity that I am good at nothing, does everything himself. That's Philippians 4:13. I can do all things in Christ. He prepares my soul and he himself, Philippians 4:13. He prepares my soul and he himself administers the thanksgiving to me and I follow him. In other words, she is getting it directly from him, what to say and what to do. No wonder the priest wants her to tell it. Now, the way of Jesus is always immense. Now, what she means is, listen, we're at a divine level, okay? It's not just immense in the sense of big. We're operating at a divine level. And together with Jesus, I too feel immense, as if I were able to do something. Then Jesus withdraws, and I remain always the stupid one that I am, the little ignorant one, the little naughty one. And it is exactly because of this that Jesus loves me, that she's little, you see. Because I'm ignorant and I'm no one and I can do nothing. It's because she acknowledges that she has her nothingness. Knowing that I want to receive him at any cost. Now, that's the issue. There's the motivation, you see. I want to receive him at any cost. So as not to receive dishonour in coming to me, but rather the highest honour, he himself prepares my poor soul. He gives me his own things, which are his merits, his clothing, his works, his desires, in sum, all of himself. If necessary, also that which the saints did, because everything is his own. If necessary, also that which our most holy mother did. Okay. Now, notice that it's the merits and grace of Blessed Mother and the saints and everything. She's clothing herself with this. And I too say to all of them, Jesus, give honour to yourself in coming to me. My Queen Mother, the saints, all the angels, I am so very poor, everything that is yours, put it in my heart, not for me, but for the honour of Jesus. And I feel that all of heaven contributes to preparing me. And after Jesus has descended within me, I seem to see him all pleased, seeing himself honoured by all his own things. And sometimes he tells me, brava, brava, my daughter, how happy I am, how pleased I am. Everything I look within you, I find, everywhere I look in you, I find things worthy of me. everything that is mine is yours. How many beautiful things you've made me find. Knowing that I'm so very poor and that I have done nothing and that nothing is mine, I laugh at the contentment of Jesus and I say, thank goodness Jesus thinks like this. I love the thank goodness. I mean, who do you think Jesus is?
Yeah, exactly.
It's enough that he came. This is enough for me. It doesn't matter that I have used his own things. Now, that's a bit like a child has to use all the stuff belonging to the parents in order to please them or do anything for them. Because if the parents don't supply it, the child doesn't have anything. Okay. And that's what Jesus is saying. Use my merits. Use the grace and the merits of the saints. Use the grace and merits of my mother. And use that so that you come to me with plenty of riches. You don't have any of your own, which I think is fascinating. The poor must receive from the rich. So that's like the child must receive from the adult. Now, it's true that a few glimmers here and there remain in me about the way Jesus works at communion. But I'm unable to reunite these glimmers together and form a preparation into thanksgiving. I lack the capacity. It seems to me that I prepare myself in Jesus himself and I thank him with Jesus himself. Now, that's it. Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah.
Okay. So, May the 24th, 1910. One who lives up high. Do you see the words?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you write over them the eagle, because that's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. The people living in the divine will are the eagles. One who lives up high in the divine will is not subject to mutations. That means you're not changing and being one thing today and something else tomorrow. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, I felt I was really a useless thing. I was unable to think of either sins, coldness or fervour. Now, this is volume 9 and she's been told endlessly that there are no sins because you can't be at this level if there are sins. You can have coldness or fervour, yes. I looked at all things in the same way. I feel indifferent to everything, naturally, because sin doesn't come into the subject here. I occupy myself with nothing but the holy will of God, but without anxiety and rather with the most perfect calm. There's your Philippians 4, 7. The peace that passes all understanding. Philippians 4, 7. I was saying to myself what a bad state mine is. Had I at least the thought of my sins, you see, this is 1910, and you're supposed to be thinking of your sins all the time. One of the traditions that has tried to come into even our day is the examine of conscience at night. Now, the examine of conscience at night is useful to somebody who's sinning, to stop them from sinning. But if you've gone way beyond that, what are you examining? Jesus says, don't think of yourself. Think only of me. And you need to know that certain traditions that we have apply to certain stages in life. Okay. But if you're married and you're talking as if you're single, there's something wrong. Okay. And if you're in a university and you're talking as if you were in a primary school, there's really something wrong. Okay. Because you've left that all behind. And you should have left the need for an examination of conscience that deals with sins if you're up at this level. Because Jesus says, you just put your attention on me, on nothing else. Okay? And she said, what a bad state mine is in, because she's reflecting that kind of thinking. Had I at least thought of my sins, yet it seems that I am happy with them, she says. Oh, holy God, what a disgrace is mine. Okay. And while I was saying this, blessed Jesus came and told me, my daughter, those who live down below, they're the seagulls at ground level, fighting and killing and yelling and making all kinds of mess. Breathing the air that everyone breathes, are forced to feel the various mutations of weather, the cold, the heat, the rain, the hail, the winds, the nighttime and daytime, okay? But the one who lives up high, that's the eagle, where the air ends, is not subject to feeling these mutations of weather because there's nothing but perfect daytime. And not feeling these mutations, naturally she has no concerns at all. The same happens to one who lives up high and lives from the divine air alone. Okay, now if you're living upon the divine air alone, you're so far away from sin, it isn't funny. So I want to give you 1 John 3:6. 1 John 3:6 to cover this paragraph. And it says, no one who lives in him keeps on sinning. Okay, it's 1 John 3:6, just to let you know it's in the Bible. No one who lives in him keeps on sinning. Now, no one who continues to sin has either seen him or known him. They're the words of John the Evangelist. But one who continues to sin has neither seen him nor known him. So, you see, Louisa has shifted away completely from the normal thinking that's in the church, okay? And she is not really acknowledging that she's living in this divine atmosphere, and that's what Jesus is telling her. Now, since my being is not subject to mutations, but it's always the same, always peaceful and in full contentment, what is the wonder that one who lives in me from my will and from my own air has no concerns about anything? Now, I know some people who are living at this very high level and they have no concerns about anything. God is Alpha, Omega and everything in between. And everything is in balance. And I asked one of them just a couple of days ago, did you have a good week? And the person smiled and said, but I always have a good week. What do you mean? I said, it's okay. It's fine. Whereas the rest of it, you have to say, did you have a good day? Yeah. Okay. So that's this living at this level where everything is in balance and everything is within the divine will. And it's miles away from all the disturbances of people living at a lower level. Okay. So would you rather live down below, that's down where the seagulls are at, yelling and screaming and roaring, like the majority does, that is outside of me? So outside of me means living in their own will. Okay. So it might be good to write it down, living in their own will. They even sing it, I did it my way, don't they? And they live from human air and from human passions. So they've got all the mess and all the hassle and all everything that goes with it. Okay. So June 2nd, 1910, if we want to rise like the eagle, we've got to die to all the muddy stuff down below. Is that okay? As I was feeling very bad, Louisa said, and as if everything was over, lamenting to Jesus about this total abandonment by him, he told me, my daughter, these are divine ways to die and to rise continuously. Now, if you even think, you don't have to do it at this moment because of the recording, but if you even think that the various stages of your own life, yeah, you have to face a difficulty, you've got to handle it, you've got to overcome it and move on. That's the dying and rising, dying and rising. You die to sin, you rise to grace. You die to this problem, you rise to a new freedom. And the whole thing is like a hurdle race in which you've got to take these hurdles. And if any hurdle is one you don't want to take, the Lord will make you do it a second time. Have you ever found yourself in circumstances that were identical? It may not be the same people and it may not be the same town, but the issues are identical what you have before. You have to wake up and realize, I failed the last test. I've got to make it this time. I have to face it. Because if you don't take that particular hurdle, you can't take the next one. You won't have the wisdom, the grace, the strength, the knowledge or anything to take the next hurdle. And each hurdle is actually numbered. And when you get to the end of it, it's absolutely fantastic. So it's dying to arise all the time. So these are divine ways, he says, to die and to rise continuously. See, nature itself is subject to these deaths and these risings. The flower is born and dies, but to rise again, even more beautiful. While if it never died, it would grow old and would lose the liveliness of its complexion and the fragrance of its scent. And here is also the simile with my being, which is ever old and ever new. Remember the famous statement of St. Augustine, "O beauty so ancient and so new, late have I loved thee." Okay, that's St. Augustine. The seed is sown under the earth, Jesus said, as though buried so as to make it die. And in fact, it does die to the point of being pulverized. And then it rises again, more beautiful and even multiplied. And so with all the rest. And of course, you have that statement. I've just remembered it now. It's in John 12. Now, memory says it's verse 24. Don't trust the memory. I'm too old. It says, unless the grain of wheat fall to the ground and die, it will not be able to bear fruit. Remember it? In John 12. If this happens in the natural order, it's much more so in the spiritual order. The soul must be subject to these deaths and to these risings, such that while it seems that she has triumphed over everything and abounds in fervour, in grace and union with me, and in virtue, that she has acquired as many new lives in everything, then I hide myself, and it seems that everything dies within her. I give the strokes of a true master. That's Ephesians 2:10. The strokes of a true master is the image of a painter working with a canvas, okay? Helping to make everything die for her. And when it appears to me that everything has died for her, like the sun, I come out, I unveil myself, and with me everything rises again, more beautiful, more vigorous, more faithful, more grateful, more humble. And in such a way that if there was anything human, death has destroyed it, making everything rise again to new life. It's a wonderful description as to why we have the darkness and the light and the night and the day and the beginnings and the endings and the troubles and all the rest of it. And why troubles persist for us in life. And we have to come to a point of recognizing that this particular trouble that's facing me, I have to name it. I have to name what is it that's being demanded of me. Because if I can name it, I can respond much better. But if, like the kid in school, I just say, the teacher doesn't like me, the teacher got at me today, that means I've nothing to learn. But if the child could look at the fact that the teacher might have had a point in saying whatever they said, then the child could learn and go on. Is that okay? So when I was young, my dad used to say, now, what did the teacher actually say? And he would go through it to make sure. But didn't you realise this is what you had to learn? So unfortunately, they don't do that now. They take the teachers to court instead. And then nobody learns anything.
Very wise man.
So July the 4th, 1910. this is the grace to die well. Wouldn't you like to know? The grace to die well. Continuing my usual state, full of privations and bitterness, I was thinking about the agony of our Lord and what the Lord and the Lord told me, my daughter. In a special way, I wanted to suffer the agony in the garden in order to help all of the dying to die well. It's not an aspect of the agony that people think of, is it? Look well at how my agony is combined with the agony of Christians, with the tedium, sadness, anguish, and the sweat of blood. Now, all the plurals there are not required in English. None of those words require a plural.
So it's kildesses,
isn't it? You know, so it's tedium, sadness, anguish. These are the experiences that people have in dying. Okay, I felt the death of all souls, and of each one in particular. That's very important if you've had death in the family to just try and remind people of that. As if I were really dying for each one in particular. So I felt the tedium, the sadness, the anguish of each one within me. And with my own, I offered help. That is, with my own sadness, tedium and anguish, I offered help, comfort, and hope to everyone, so that as I felt their deaths within me, they all might receive the grace to die in me. So that's one of the clues as to how to pray for the dying. Okay. Jesus, you suffered everything for them so that they could die well. I take all your agony in the garden and I apply it to all the dying. Okay. So I gave them the grace to die in me as though in one single breath, with my breath, to be beatified immediately in my divinity. Now notice, his desire is that we would go straight up to be beatified immediately. If the agony in the garden was in a special way for the dying, the agony on the cross was for help at the last moment. Isn't that absolutely fantastic? At the very last breath. So here again, you've got an A and a B. There's two stages in the dying. One is the dying process and the other is the last breath. They are both agonies, but one is different from the other. The agony in the garden, full of sadness, fear, anxiety and fright. The agony on the cross, full of peace and imperturbable calm. How many of us have actually noticed somebody dying and they go from agony into complete calm? I'm always fascinated when I've seen that. But if I cried out, I thirst, it was the insatiable thirst that all might breathe their last in my last breath. What a wonderful thing to pray for the dying. And in seeing that many would go out of my last breath, out of grief, I cried, Sitio, I thirst. And this Sitio still continues to cry out to all and to each one like a bell at the door of their heart. I thirst for you, O soul. I remember giving retreats in some of Mother Teresa of Calcutta's communities in different places. And they always had a big plain crucifix. You know, it had the corpus on it over the tabernacle and a big I thirst beside it. So that they would continue to intercede for the dying and intercede for souls. I thirst. I thirst for you, O soul. Please never go out of me, but enter into me and breathe your last in me. So somebody who would breathe their last in him, of course, their salvation is assured. So the hours of my passion were six. He suffered for 6 hours. While I gave to men, which I gave to the human race in order to die well. The 3 hours in the garden were for help in the agony. The three on the cross for help at the very last breath. After this, who could not look at death with a smile? Isn't that amazing? More so for one who actually loves me and one who tries to sacrifice himself on my very cross, that the victim souls. Do you see how beautiful death is and how things have changed? In life, I was despised. That's Isaiah 53:3. He was despised and we took no notice of him. 53:3. The very miracles did not produce the effects of my death. Even up to the cross, there were insults. But as soon as I breathed my last, death had the power to change things. Now, I want to give you Luke 23:48. Now, he's going to say something here that's both in Luke and in John. John emphasizes the fact that and in the very dying of Jesus. Now, I'm talking about the last hour or maybe less. There was total silence around the cross. Everybody was completely fascinated at the way this man was dying. Okay. Luke is the one who says they began to beat their breasts, which is a sign of mourning and sorrow, that they had done something terrible. That's Luke 23:48. So watch this now. As soon as I breathed my last, death had the power to change things. All beat their breasts, confessing me as the true Son of God. Notice the word A-double-L.
Yeah.
Now, the statement in Luke wouldn't leave you with the word all did it. It said people went home beating their breasts. But you wouldn't get the impression that every single one of them did it. Whereas Jesus says here that all beat their breasts, confessing me as the true Son of God. Now, if they did that immediately on the death of Jesus, then they were ready when the news of the resurrection would be given to them, and even more so when Pentecost would come and would explain why there was 3,000 converted on the day of Pentecost. You see, you've got to be disposed. Throughout these writings, Jesus will say, you can't have something unless you're disposed to it. That there has to be some kind of preparation there. Okay. My very disciples, he said, plucked up courage, and even those who were hidden, that's Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, became brave and asked for my body, giving me honourable burial. That's Luke 23:50. Heaven and earth in full voice confessed me as the Son of God. Now heaven, because the sun refused to give its light, and earth because of the earthquake, in full voice confessed me as the Son of God. Death did something great, something sublime. And this happens also for my own children. Now, his own children are the ones who are living in union with him, and most particularly the divine will. In life, they're despised and oppressed. Those very virtues which, like light, should make those around them start remain half veiled. Their heroism in suffering, their abnegation, their zeal for soul cast lights and doubts on those who surround them. And I myself permit these veils so as to preserve with more safety the virtue of my dear children. But as soon as they die, I withdraw these veils. Now, that happened very dramatically with St. Therese of Lisieux. She was an absolute nobody until she died. And all of a sudden, there was this storm of glory. Within months, she was being celebrated around the world. That the nothingness and the celebration could only be called death and resurrection. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely incredible. And, you know, everybody who knew her said, this is unbelievable. The world is celebrating a woman they never knew. Mm-hmm. You know, and it only took her own little story of a soul to do it. And she told it so simply that she was telling anybody they could become a saint. So he said, I myself permit these veils so as to preserve with more safety the virtue of my dear children. But as soon as they die, I withdraw the veils since they're no longer necessary. And the doubts become certainties, the light becomes clear, and this light makes others appreciate their heroism. They pay esteem to everything, even to the smallest things, as I've just said about St. Therese. Therefore, what cannot be done in life is made up for by death. You'd have to say by a death in Christ, a death in grace, a death in the divine will, because not everybody who dies is celebrated afterwards, are they? This, as for what happens down here, that which happens up there, that is in heaven, is truly surprising and enviable to all mortals, but he won't tell us what it is. Okay. So I want to give you another one. That's July the 8th, 1910. And the heading is Living Tabernacles. And I want to give it to you because we've already had something on communion. Okay. For Jesus, our body is like the tabernacle. Isn't that fantastic? Mm. So I want to give you 1 Corinthians 3:16. Know you not that you are the tabernacle of the Most High, and the Holy Spirit dwells in you. So being very afflicted because of the privation of my highest good, Louisa said, and having received communion, in receiving the Holy Host, it stopped in my throat. And as I suckled it in order to push it down, I suckled a sweet and delicious humour, she says. Now, the dictionary won't any longer hold the word humour. And I've written above it mood, experience. I'm not completely sure. The word humour isn't used anymore. Then, and we'll try and pick it up from reading it. Then after suckling very much, the host went down, and I could see the host changed into a baby who said, your body is my tabernacle. There's your 1 Corinthians 3:16. Your soul is the pyx that contains me. Now, using that language is perfect because 1 Corinthians 3:16 says, "Know you not that you are the temple of the living God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you?" Well, if you go to the temple in Jerusalem, the presence of God was in the Holy of Holies. That's the pyx in the tabernacle, in the church. So he says, your body and then the pyx inside your innermost being. The beating of your heart is like the host that serves me in order to transform myself into you as if within a host. But with this difference, that in the host, as it is consumed, I am subject to continuous death. While with the beating of your heart symbolizing your love, it's not subject to being consumed, and so my life is continuous. Therefore, why so much affliction about my privations? If you don't see me, you feel me. And if you don't feel me, you touch me. Now that's 1 Peter 1:8. You don't see him, but you actually experience him. And your joy is so glorious, Peter says. I think it's 8 to 10. 1 Peter 1:8-10. So he says, look, you're making all this fuss about my privations, and yet you can feel me within you. He's actually present within her. It's not just a grace, because we can have graces we don't feel, isn't that right? Mm-hmm. Because they're on a spiritual level. He says, you actually feel me. I am actually present in you. If you don't feel me, you actually touch me. And now, with the fragrance of my perfumes, which diffuse around you, or this now business I hate, it should be, or else you have the fragrance of my perfumes, or else you have my light in which you feel invested, or you have, by making a liqueur that cannot be found on the earth, descend into you. Now notice, she has mentioned a number of times that liqueur, hasn't she? Mm-hmm. He says it's not made on earth. So that while she tastes it like a liqueur and it looks like that, in actual fact, it's spiritual. Okay. It cannot be found on the earth, descend into you. Or by just simply touching you, and the many other ways which are invisible to you. Now, that long sentence, which is very awkward and it's not good English at all, is simply describing the many ways that the Lord comes to Louisa all the time, whether she's in her privations or not. And we have read passages in which she said, yeah, he put his arm out just to tell her that he was there, you know, or whatever. So in the next paragraph, he's going to be talking about this fragrance of love. So I want to give you the Song of Songs, chapter 4, verse 10. Song of Songs, chapter 4, verse 10. Now, in order to obey, Louisa said, I will write these things that Jesus says to me often, and also while being fully awake. Now, fully awake means she's not in ecstasy. These fragrances, I myself am unable to tell what kind they are. I call the fragrance of love. And I feel it at communion. If I pray, if I work, especially if I have not seen him, and I say to myself, today he hasn't come. Don't you know, Jesus, that without you I cannot be, nor do I want to be. And immediately and almost suddenly, I feel as though invested by that fragrance. I know somebody in Ireland today who experiences these fragrances quite frequently. Other times, as I move, or if I move in the bed sheets, I feel the fragrance coming out. And in my interior, I hear him say, I am here. Now, this fragrance traditionally is called the odour of sanctity. The odour of sanctity. So I hear him say, I am here. Other times, well, I'm all afflicted. As I go about raising my eyes, a ray of light comes before my sight. And that light is the divine will. And it's the presence of the Lord. Just put DW there. So that which alone makes me happy is Jesus. Now, he sends her all of these signs. She doesn't care a hoot about any of them. She only wants him. So what you're hearing is someone who is truly in love. And all the rest, she said, I receive with indifference. I absolutely love it. You have the same kind of thing in John chapter 20, verses 1 to 10. Mary of Magdala meets two angels. She's not remotely interested in them. She simply wants to know where Jesus is. And she says, if you've taken him, just tell me where he is and I'll get him. And it doesn't occur to her at all that she's talking to two spiritual beings. So I'll leave it there so we can have a discussion.